Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week, Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers, so let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed. Hello, and welcome to the DeathCast. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our first look at a new case for us this week, the story of Gary Heinrich. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the DeathCast, DeathCast Official, or DeathCast True Crime. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon, where, just like my friends Channel and Anthony, you can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content, such as the case against Vince McMahon, as well as the multi-part series on Columbine, all for $1.99 a month. If you can't afford that and you'd still like to help support the show, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, as well as subscribe to the show and share it on social media. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Our story really begins on the night of March 24th into the morning of March 25th, 1987. When 25-year-old Josefina Rivera was dropped off at a Philadelphia gas station located at 6th and Gerard Street by 44-year-old Gary Michael Heidnick. to outward appearances, everything seemed to be okay. Rivera had known Heidnik for roughly 4 months, and he was dropping her off so that she could go and see her children before meeting up with a friend of hers, at which point the two women would return to the gas station where Heidnik would be waiting for them. However, the moment Heidnik left the gas station in his Cadillac, Rivera ran roughly 4 blocks to the apartment of her boyfriend, Victor Rivera. Victor opened the door and was shocked to see Josefina, who he had assumed had left him 4 months prior. And as soon as he saw Josefina, she starts telling him this crazy story about how she had been kidnapped, raped, and held as a prisoner with 5 other women for the last 4 months, and that 2 of these women were dead. Rivera's boyfriend did not believe her. He thought that something was wrong with her mentally, and he convinces her that they need to go to this rendezvous point with Heinrich so she can confront him. He does this thinking that, again, she's full of shit. And the 2 of them begin walking towards the gas station when Josefina reconsiders, thinking about these other women that she has told her boyfriend are still captive in the basement. And telling her boyfriend this, Josefina decides that she is going to call the police, which she promptly does from a payphone, reaching officers from the 25th Precinct of Philadelphia. And the officers arrive fairly quickly, and they start hearing the story that Josefina has to tell them, and they too do not believe the things that she is informing the officers about. She's talking about sex slaves being held captive, torture, cannibalism, all sorts of things that to these officers are just absolutely unbelievable, and they believe that they may in fact be dealing with a crazy woman. So Josefina and her boyfriend are brought down to the police station where they're each questioned separately. Now, Victor tells the officers that he doesn't believe any of the things that she's telling him. He hasn't seen her in months. And that Josefina just showed up at his house that evening, spinning this wild and crazy story. In the other interrogation room, Josefina is doing her best to tell the officers everything that she can remember, giving them names, that type of thing, and the officers still are not believing her. It is not until Josefina begins showing the officers marks on her body from various forms of torture, as well as from the manacles that were kept on her legs and on her wrists during some of these torture sessions, that they begin to believe that this woman may in fact have gone through a traumatic event. So armed with this knowledge, the officers leave the precinct and drive off to this gas station where they find the Cadillac sitting, waiting. The motor is running. Inside is a 44-year-old white man named Joseph Heidnik. They approach the vehicle from the passenger and driver's sides with guns drawn. And upon seeing them, Heidnik seems confused. They tell him that he's under arrest. He's asking him if this is because of his missed child support payments. They tell him that it's much more serious than that. Heidnik continues to play dumb and continues to ask them if this is over the child support payments. So now we've got this man, Gary Heidnik, in custody. he's playing dumb as to what's going on. The officers learn the location from Rivera where she and these other women had built and held captive, and also learn that there are still three women inside of Heidnik's North Philadelphia house, which is located in a rundown section of the city at 3520 North Marshall Street. Officers are dispatched to the house. The assistant district attorney is contacted and is informed that they have a possible homicide and that they need a search warrant in order to enter the house. One of the first things that officers note when they arrive at the house is that the yard is much like those around it, somewhat unkempt. The basement windows appear to be blocked off from the inside. At roughly 4:30 a.m. on the morning of March 26th, word comes down that the search warrant has been approved, and officers attempt to gain access to the home using keys that Heidnik had given to them. Unfortunately, none of the keys seem to fit, and they have to use a crowbar in order to gain access to the dwelling. What they find inside is something straight out of a horror movie. In fact, the man, Gary Heidnik, would later serve as one of the inspirations for the character of Buffalo Bill from Thomas Harris's best-selling novel, The Silence of the Lambs. If you've never read the book, you've almost certainly seen the movie starring Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins. The killer in that movie, who plans on making a female outfit out of his cat, most notably Ed Gein, serial killer Ted Bundy, and Gary Heidnik. Now, at the time the officers enter Heidnik's home, they really only know what Josefina Rivera has told them, which is simply that Heidnik has women captive in the house, two of them have died, and that he has been subjecting all of these women to, you know, rape, torture, deprivation of civil liberties, food, clothing, that type of thing. And upon entering this house, the officers start going through it. They notice a couple of things right away. There is a large stock pot on the stove that the inside of which is charred, and there is a yellowish substance around the rim of this stock pot. This yellowish substance is never able to definitively be identified. They also notice inside of the oven that there is a pan inside of which appears to be a rib. Now, Josefina had informed the officers that Heidnik had made them eat the bodies of two of the victims, and he also had fed some of the victims to his dogs. So, right away, upon seeing these things, the officers are getting an uneasy feeling. It's when they open the freezer in the kitchen that the shock and reality of what it is that they are dealing with actually hits them, as lying inside of the freezer is a human forearm. And that story that is about to unfold before all of them is, in the words of numerous officers involved in this case, the most horrific case that they ever worked. So, let's go way back to the beginning and explore who exactly is Gary. Gary Michael Heidnik was born November 22nd, 1943, in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. called Eastlake. His father, Michael, was a tool and die maker, while his mother, Ellen, was a beautician. Their early years in the Heidnik home have been described as middle class. Some point after Gary was born, his parents had another child named Terry. And according to Gary and his brother, there was always strife in the house, even from the earliest days. Indeed, in 1946, Michael and Ellen got divorced, with both boys going to live with their mother, who they later described as an abusive alcoholic. And the two boys lived with their mother for a few years before moving in with their father. This is undoubtedly because of their mother's erratic behavior and her propensity to get married, then divorced, leading to upheaval within the family, only to get married again. Their mother was married at least four times and had numerous boyfriends throughout her life, who the boys described as being indifferent towards them or their plight. Moving in with their father was no better, however, as both Heidnichs would later state that their father was just as abusive, if not more so, than their mother. And some people may look at this and think, you know, it's just, you know, two boys who are going to grow up and have severe mental issues, blaming their parents for their problems. However, in interviews after Gary's arrest, it is strikingly apparent that his father has no use for his sons, sees them as being little more than burdens, and does not love or respect either of them in any fashion. Michael had remarried in the interim between his divorce from Ellen and his sons moving back in with them, and neither boy got along with their stepmother. However, it was, again, their father who they said was the absolute worst. Gary had a lifelong problem with bedwetting, and he stated that when he wet the bed, his father would take the sheets and hang them outside for everyone in their neighborhood to see, causing him a lot of shame. Gary also stated that it wasn't just the bed sheets that his father would hang out the window. When he was really angry at his sons, he would grab them by their ankles and dangle them out the second story window. With Terry later stating that when their father was extremely displeased with them, he would paint bull's eyes on the backside of their pants and send them to school dressed like this. Whether or not any of this is true, unfortunately, we cannot, you know, verify, but the fact that the two of them gave very similar stories makes it more likely than not that Michael Heidnik was an absolute monster of a man towards his children. Having said that, though, it does not excuse his oldest son from the crimes that he is going to go out and commit. According to Terry, his brother had other issues at school that had nothing to do with their father. Terry stated that not long after starting school, his brother had fallen out of a tree and landed on his head, which caused the other children to call him Football Head due to the shape of his skull. He also said that with this injury, a change came in personality, and that his brother, who was normally fairly docile became much more aggressive and combative to everyone in the house. Outside of all these things, it's said that Gary Heidnik had a fairly quote-unquote normal childhood, joining the Boy Scouts, getting summer jobs, dating young women, although he was said to be rather shy and did not date very often. It's also known that he took a very early interest in the military and in the stock market, so much so that Gary would become something of a whiz investor when he eventually opens his own church, which we'll get to at some point. These were the things that he used to occupy his time. Now, Gary had a very high IQ. At one point, it was scored at around 130. And if you consider an average IQ is looked at as 100, you can see he was a fairly intelligent individual. And it was with this in mind that his father got together enough money to send Gary to military school when he was in the 9th grade. And the school he ends up going to was a fairly prestigious school called the Staunton Military Academy in Virginia. And Gary ends up spending 2 years there, where it was stated that he was an exceptional student who is not seen as a disciplinary problem. Now, this next piece of information comes from Gary Heidnik himself. He later told mental health professionals that it was during his time at the Staunton Military Academy that he decided to go and seek help from mental health care professionals for the first time. Now, we don't know what, if anything, occurred during these sessions, or even if any of these sessions actually took place, as Gary was a minor during this period of time, and he never gave specifics about the psychiatrists that he saw. However, what we know of his later life, in that he did in fact have many encounters with mental health professionals, and that he in fact sought them out himself, it is very likely that he did indeed go and see these psychiatrists during this period of time. After his sophomore year, Gary decides that military school is not for him. He convinces his father to let him to return home, and he ends up bouncing around high schools for a little while. In 1961, Gary Heidnik, with the permission of his father, decides to join the army, reasoning that this is what he wants most from life. So Gary ends up leaving Ohio and going to boot camp. And while he would return to Ohio once briefly after his enlistment, he will never again go back to his hometown. Gary's time in the military really is a turning point for his life. We know that upon graduating from boot camp, he had attempted to get different jobs, such as a military police officer, a heavy equipment operator, a stenographer, and he was turned down for all of these, and the military gave him one option, which was to become a medic. We also know that while he was in medic school, Gary basically became a loan shark. He would lend money to other service members and then charge them a fee when they paid that money back to him. And he was doing fairly well when Gary ends up getting his orders to report to Landstuhl, West Germany, in May of 1962, he lamented to people later on in life that he had an estimated $5,000 in loans out to other service members. That's a considerable amount of change. I don't care if it's 1962 or 2024. But in 1962, that is a lot of money. And to have lost this money must have been quite a blow. So now Heideck is in Germany. He's working as an orderly. He gets his GED, scoring in the top 96th percentile, which, as someone who scored higher than that, I can tell you is extremely difficult to do. He seems to be doing good. On August 25th, 1962, Gary Heideck asks to go visit sick hall. For those who've never been in the military, in the morning, the infirmary will have sick hall, which is where individuals, you know, who have various aches, pains, and illnesses can go down and see the doctor. They allow you to come in throughout the day, but generally speaking, that's where you would go if, say, you woke up in the morning and you have the flu. You can't just call out of work. It's not like a normal job. You have to show up at muster, and then you request to go to sick hall. So Gary goes and asks to see a doctor, and he informs them that he's having headaches, dizzy spells, and blurred vision. In addition to this, Gary informs the doctor that he is nauseous nearly constantly and is unable to keep anything down. Now, in his medical chart from the military, the doctor noted that Gary had a visible tick in his neck, or such a that every few moments his head would suddenly jerk violently to one side. And it's because of this that Gary is sent to see a neurologist who says Gary has gastroenteritis, which is really a inflammation of the intestines. It's a bacteria. It can be treated with medication. But he also notes that Gary seems to be suffering from what, in his words, are either a schizoid personality or full-blown schizophrenia. However, other doctors who would later look at his records would state that to them, Heydrich's symptoms at that period of time pointed not so much to a mental disorder as it did to using hallucinogens such as LSD or magic mushrooms. Now, whatever is the case, this diagnosis is going to stick with Gary for the rest of his life. And it's going to lead Gary to getting sent back to the United States against his wishes, really. On October 25th of 1962, Gary is transferred to the mental hospital in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, where Gary admits to one of the psychologists that at times he sees objects moving, which ends up in his records as having hallucinations. It's really difficult to piece together whether or not he was actually suffering from these symptoms or he had tried some form of illicit drug and realized that if he told people in authority that he was seeing these things, they would believe him and that he could get kicked out of the military with an honorable discharge and put on disability, thus ensuring that he has a constant stream of income. What we do know is that Gary Heidick does indeed get honorably discharged from the military. And at first he's put on 10% disability, although later the government would move this up to 100% disability. After being discharged, Gary settles in the Philadelphia area, where he ends up going to college, getting his degree as a licensed practicing nurse, after which he gets a job working at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital, training to be a psychiatric nurse working at the VA hospital in Coatesville. Although Gary does not finish this particular course, as he is thrown out of the program due to quote-unquote poor attendance and a bad attitude. After this, Gary briefly returns to Ohio, where he attempts to mend fences with his father and stepfather. However, this has disastrous results, as the elder Heidick wants nothing to do with his firstborn son and makes it plainly apparent that he sees his son as a disgrace and a... Gary ends up going back to Pennsylvania, taking up residence again in Philadelphia. It doesn't appear as though he has any form of steady employment from this point on. However, he is still getting his disability from the military, which amounts to somewhere between $1,500 and $2,500 a month, depending on the source that you look at. He also starts going into mental hospitals fairly frequently, known number being 22 different times. This is between 1962 and 1987. And that the majority of these are self-admittals, wherein he goes, he tells them, you know, he's having a problem, what's his past mental history, etc., and they admit him for a period of time. But also, Gary starts making suicide attempts. Now, during his later prosecution, the prosecutors will say that many of these attempts were not serious. However, the documented evidence shows that this is in fact not the case. At one point, Gary drives a motorcycle head-on into a semi-truck. It's also known that he attempted to hang himself, OD'd numerous times on his medications, and ate a broken light bulb. Interestingly enough, Gary is suffering from whatever this mental illness is. His brother Terry is also suffering from it, and the two brothers would take turns, it seems, bringing the other into the mental hospital. In 1970, Gary's mother, suffering from alcoholism, married for the fifth time, is diagnosed with bone cancer. On May 30th of that year, she drinks a bottle of mercuric chloride, which is a chemical that is found in most beauty supply shops, and she takes her own life. And I found one article that stated that shortly after his mother's death, Gary ends up going mute, which was something that seemed to happen quite often, particularly when he was in the midst of one of his mental episodes. More often than not, this would happen when he was in the hospital. He would suddenly go mute and not speak for days, weeks, or even months. instead writing notes to whoever it was that he was talking to before one day simply beginning to speak again. Whether this was actually a condition of whatever it was that he was suffering from or not, you're going to see later that Gary seems to have been able to turn this on and off. He didn't just write notes, however, when he would go into these silent periods. Sometimes he would use American Sign Language. Other times, he would simply sit and stare. Notes from these periods of time state that when he began to speak again, he often had slurred speech, appeared disoriented, and had wandering, racing thoughts. However, again, you're going to see a little later on that even this in and of itself may be questionable. During Gary's various visits, he would oftentimes leave these hospitals against medical advice. During one such escapade, when he simply walked away from the hospital, he ends up getting arrested for driving a motorcycle with a broken headlight and brought back to the hospital as an escaped mental patient. In conjunction with all of this, Gary Heidick had a fairly active sex life, which is rather interesting when you consider all of the mental problems he is supposed to be suffering from. It's known that there were numerous women that he met during the 1960s who would become casual sexual partners with him and would continue with these liaisons with him almost up until the day that he was arrested. However, Gary had a penchant for going after women who were mentally handicapped. And unfortunately, as you're going to see, some of his victims were in this category. He preferred African-American women almost exclusively, although Gary would take whatever woman that he could find at a given time. He seems to have preferred to target women who, for lack of a better term, he was mentally superior to and could therefore control and lord himself over, oftentimes to the detriment of these women. And psychologists would later state that Gary suffered from a severe inferiority complex, and that was one of the reasons why he targeted these women, because he was able to control them in such a fashion, it made him feel superior to them. And this ties into the hospitalization that occurred after Gary had the head-on collision with the motorcycle. Doctors at the psychiatric hospital noted that he needed to be in a position of authority, which is very telling given what he is going to perpetrate in the coming. After these hospitalizations leading up to the mid-1960s, Gary's stays in hospital wards really start to blur together. He was self-admitted at one point, and it was found that he had tied a string around his toe in an effort to induce gangrene by which he hoped to kill himself. Another, he was admitted after hitting his brother Terry over the head with a 2x4. This one was particularly interesting because Terry, lying on the ground, said basically, "What the hell is wrong with you? You could have killed me." Gary responded by informing his brother that if he had killed him, he would have placed his body inside of the bathtub and carefully mixed some acid up to dissolve the body so as not to damage the drains, and that if there were any large bones left over, Gary would have used a saw to get rid of them, disposing of the remains in various trash cans throughout the neighborhood. So we can already see Gary Heidick is having homicidal ideations, thoughts of murder, plotting and planning in his mind, it would seem, of ways to get rid of human remains. Upon this admittance, it was noted that the 27-year-old Gary Heidick had gone through an upheaval the day before when his live-in girlfriend, who was 37 years old and was mentally handicapped, had walked out on him. And this is a pattern that we are going to see repeat itself throughout Gary's life. These mentally handicapped black women being involved with Gary only to leave him. However, some of them are not seen again. Now, whether this means that Gary did something to them, or they ended up being institutionalized somewhere and simply forgotten about, unfortunately, we'll never know. But it's important to take note of this fact at this point, as well as the fact that Gary so succinctly explained to his brother how he would get rid of his body, and has led some researchers to speculate whether or not Gary may not have committed serious violent crimes much earlier than we are aware of. And back to his various hospital stays, during this latter part of the 1960s, it was noted that Gary began wearing a black leather motorcycle jacket, which he would refuse to take off or have cleaned, and that this, along with various personal tics, were such as saluting people for no reason, were things that he once started would never give up. Meaning, once he started doing a particular thing or became fixated on having a particular object, he would hold on to them no matter the condition or how odd the things that he was doing seemed to others. From roughly the end of 1960 to the beginning of 1971, Gary has no known hospital stays. Eventually, though, he is going to go through the cycle again of hospital stays, 1971, 72, where on September 19th, he is discharged from yet another mental hospital. And the next portion of Gary's life is kind of funny because, inexplicably, he is not known to have been institutionalized again for another 6 years. Why is that inexplicable? Well, given his prior mental health problems and the frequency with which he was both going into mental health wards as well as committing suicide, it is very curious as well as odd that there are no records of Gary Heidick going into any further treatment centers during this period of time. And it raises the question as to whether or not he was faking his mental illnesses all along or had put himself into hospitals in other states under assumed names, or was simply living in a state of psychosis during this period of time, and those around him, including himself, decided not to seek further treatment. Unfortunately, we'll never know the answers to these questions. What we do know, however, is that prior to this last hospitalization in 1972, In 1971, Gary Heidick suddenly got a strong desire to become religious. According to Gary, sometime during the spring of 1971, he began to have an open dialogue with God. This would eventually grow into an open dialogue with Jesus Christ himself. Some have pointed to this as proof that Gary was suffering from schizophrenia, you know, auditory and visual hallucinations. Now again, this information comes directly from Gary. On this morning, he climbed into his Plymouth, intending to drive down the street to get coffee and a donut. Instead, he drove to Malibu, California, and upon reaching the beach, he heard the voice of God, which instructed him to return to Philadelphia and create a new church which was designed specifically to cater to the spiritual needs of the physically disabled and the mentally handicapped. Further, Gary claimed that from this day forward, he would regularly commune with God and his son Jesus, and that Jesus actually gave him stock market tips. You can't make this shit up, people. After returning from California, Gary goes through his normal routine, ending up once again in a mental hospital. And it was during this stay that he decided to incorporate the United Ministries of God. And this was, in fact, incorporated on October 12th, 1971, with himself listed as bishop, his brother Terry, a woman he was living with at the time, and numerous other individuals listed as the board of directors. There was also a 5-page constitution attached to this, which in later years would lead to some legal wrangling in the court. As bishop, Gary was the head of the church and was in charge of the church's finances. And what Gary's going to end up doing is he's going to end up taking the donations that he is able to get for the church, and in the church's name, he is going to put this money into the stock market through an account with Merrill Lynch. And the church, and indeed Gary, does very, very well. At the time of his arrest, he had almost $600,000 in this account, which is the equivalent of over $2 million today. In this constitution, it laid out how finances for the church were to be dispersed. Basically, the finances were to be used to buy assets for the church, including a fleet of vehicles that were really driven by Gary himself. It also covered spiritual and secular matters, stating at one point that while it's understood that Jesus was not the Son of God, he is seen as the prophet of God and shall be treated as such. Once Gary ends up getting out of this hospital stay, he starts holding regular services on Sundays, wherever it is that he happens to be living, with a friend of him is a mentally challenged man by the name of Tony Brown, acting as something of a church deacon. Brown would take one of the various vehicles that belonged to the church and drive around picking up individuals to come to the service. Now, most of these individuals lived in group homes where Heidenreich would also get some of his various sexual partners from. And they would all be brought back to the wherever it was that Gary was living, and they would have a short service. Gary would help those attending learn to read the hymns and various Bible passages, as well as sing them. Afterwards, he would take everyone out to a meal, usually at a local McDonald's. Now, all of this sounds, you know, on the surface to be done in very good faith. However, knowing what we now know about Gary Heidick, it can be seen that there was a nefarious angle to all of this. Yes, the church was set up and it was really a tax haven so that Gary could live as he wanted, but also he was taking advantage of female parishioners from this church who were really not mentally equipped to deal with an individual such as him. And when I say he's taking advantage of them, again, he was having sexual relations with many of these women. And as such, because they're not in full control of their mental faculties due to no fault of their own, he is able to get them to do the things that he wants for his own gratification. However, at this point in time, no one is aware of that. We're going to leave the story at this point. It's the mid-1970s. Gary is acting as the bishop in this church. He's living in his own little fantasy world, completely separated from the rest of reality, and for the most part, no one is aware of the things that he is doing. I hope that you have enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay morbid.